Hello, everyone. This is Eric Pennington, and welcome to the Spirit of EQ podcast. We're glad that you've tuned in. A few things we wanted to tell you at the beginning of the show, and that's this podcast was created to be a tool to help you, primarily to discover and grow your EQ. Science and our own lived experiences confirm that the better we are at managing our emotions, the better we're going to be at making decisions, which leads to a better life. And that's something we all want. We're glad that you've taken out the time today to listen and hope that something that you hear will lead to a breakthrough. Hey, one last thing. We'd really appreciate a review on whichever platform you use to listen. And if you want to, leave some comments about what you heard today, as well as follow and subscribe. That way you won't miss a single episode as we continue this journey. And with that, the show begins. Welcome, everyone. I'm Eric Pennington, and welcome to the Spirit of EQ podcast. Joining me today are Tina Schweiger and Michelle Stinson Ross, founder, co-founder of Fuelytics. They are not new to the Spirit of EQ podcast, but I think we had you guys on maybe, it's probably been 2 years ago-ish.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And, I mean, it's like so much of life and so much of this work, you know, you're on my mind and I got to get with you to get you back on. And we finally pulled it off. So I'm super excited to have you guys here. Welcome.
Thanks. We're excited to be here.
So let's start with a bit of an update because our audience may or may not remember. It used to be your company was Mindful Appy. Did I get that right?
Mm-hmm.
And then you guys did a pivot with the name and the branding type thing. So would you guys want to maybe touch on that a little bit? Maybe what that sort of was the catalyst for that happening and why and all that good stuff?
Do you want to take that one or I should take that one?
Go for it, Tina.
Okay. You know, Mindful Appy is, I think every company that starts with a name, you eventually renames it at some point, and we're no different.
Right.
Mindful Appy, our starter name was really about mindfulness and combining that with technology. Ultimately, we don't have what would be traditionally considered an app. Our app is software, so it could be confusing for some. And we didn't really feel like it captured what it is. We were really the core of our business, which is taking emotions and turning them into data. So that allowed us to pivot to something called Fuelytics. And so putting those two things together kept us in a really neat brand area, but allows us the flexibility for the myriad of use cases that we continue to develop.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. And I spoke, we were speaking before off air that I really love the name. For me, it just resonates, right?
Thank you.
And I also like how you guys are doing what I think is ultra cool in the emotions space, because emotions are data. Mm-hmm. And you're like sort of extracting it in a sort of a technological way. How's been the reception beyond sort of those that know you and all that, whether it be investors or just clients or whatever the case may be?
The client adoption has been really exceptional. We have been really, really pleased with how quickly people get it, especially in situations where one of us might be speaking at a public event. Tina and I have both done several over the years.
Right.
The easy understanding of, oh, wait a second. You can give us emotional data at scale for like business use. Okay, tell me more. As a majority women-owned company, the investor side of it is a little bit trickier. Also, let's just be honest, when it comes to people willing to put money into something, they're not likely to put it into something that they don't understand. And as soon as we start talking about emotions and data, most investors go, what?
Yeah.
So it's a bit of a double-edged sword. People that actually have to use the data and know they need the data, absolutely love it. Somebody that's just putting money in and kind of gambling on us a little bit, they're not quite there with it yet.
And I would add on, just on the academic side, we have networked and met and made connections with professors and academics. And on that side, there's a lot of interest and a lot of enthusiasm. A lot of academics do see it as a next frontier in data analytics that's not currently being really looked at that much. But a lot of academics also see the potential.
Do you guys find that curious that since emotions drive so much of behavior, it's the thing that has pretty much been ignored?
Exactly.
Yeah. Well,
culturally, we're taught to ignore it when you think about it. Because of the way we collect data by not using words, but by using emoji, we often wind up in discussions about emotional literacy, those sorts of things. And it's been really apparent to us through those discussions that, especially in the U.S., I'm not going to talk about other cultures that I'm not a part of, but at least in the American culture, we're not taught a lexicon as we're growing up. We are, as children, usually told not to act out. So when you think about, you know, the negative emotions and the childlike expression of those and how awkward they make things in public situations, it's like, parenting-wise, we immediately crack down on it. We, as children, had it immediately cracked down. I mean, Tina has a whole story about how she was constantly told not to be so emotional, and it makes it difficult. All of the signals around you tell you that those emotions aren't important, don't pay attention to them, blah, 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 blah. It's just noise. And so it's not really surprising that, despite the fact that in our brains and in our bodies, we use emotions as signals to make decisions and whatever, when it comes to the outside world and the perception of it, of course, you know, you zoom out just a little bit and it makes total sense why it's so hard to get people to like embrace that, because we're not taught to embrace it.
Yeah. Not to mention the fact that our brains will normalize just about anything. Mm-hmm. And I always forget her name. I want to say it's Lisa Feldman. I can't remember. It's Feldman and then her married name. She's brilliant. I saw her on an Andrew Huberman podcast, and her focus is on emotions. And she used this term that in many ways, our brain operates on an ideal of best guesses. Now, on the face of that, right, you go, hold on, wait a minute. You're this scientific giant who's done all kinds of research, and you're saying our brain operates on a best guesses front. And as I'm listening more, and I go, that's exactly what it is. This is because of where we grew up, who our parents were, what our environment was. Our brain is just operating on here's what we should do, and given the circumstances, the beliefs, all the rest.
Right.
And I think, to your point, that it really does. When you take a step back, when you zoom out, you go, yeah, it makes total sense, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's interesting how much it drives our decisions, every decision. But until you get to the place as an individual where, I mean, even in business, as, you know, having been a recipient of coaching, you know, you're often taught, you know, hey, if you're feeling emotional about a situation, delay that decision, you know, because those emotions can drive you to make bad decisions or react in ways that you wish you wouldn't have later. So emotions, in as it comes to business and decisions, are inherently scary.
Yeah.
So that is also a compounding factor.
No doubt.
And it's not that's bad advice too. I mean, we could dig into that for just a second. It's not bad advice to say, let's not make this decision yet. The piece of advice that we're missing there is that if you're feeling emotional about a decision, sit with those emotions and process them. Why am I feeling this way? Because that's a signal about what how I should be making this decision. And that's the missing piece, right? We're told, you know, not to be emotional about it. No, actually, we just need to process the emotion and understand what that signal's about.
And, you know, that's a great point because it makes me think about sort of the analogy of don't go out in the rain. It's going to stop in the next 20 minutes. But there's no why behind it. There's no, well, what should I do while I'm waiting? And I think of what you just said is that what should you do when you are waiting, when you're pausing and sitting with it? That's awesome. All right. So anything related to, I mean, you're in the new era, the new branding, if you will. What are you working on right now with the company by way of update for our audience?
Please, Dina, go for it.
Well, before we talked about this yesterday, and I do want to announce, we did validate our use of emoji. We have a research partner in England, Dr. Linda Kay of Edgehill University, who studies cyber psychology and emoji. And she partnered with us on a study that took the positive and negative affect scale that we licensed from the authors of the scale and from the American Psychological Association. And we asked people how they felt in the moment on that scale. And then we asked them how they felt in regards to the emoji scale. And not only did we find some really impressive correlations that indicate that it's pretty valid, but it was also published in a peer-reviewed journal about humans in computer behavior, or I should have the name right exactly, but humans in computer behavior. So that was a really big development because we were really operating on research and hypothesis and our own testing, but to really gather 700 or 800 data points and have those data points all point in that direction, that the use of emoji is a valid way to capture an emotional reaction. And interestingly, it's not a good way to capture a linguistic definition of an emoji, of an emotion. So if you have an emoji symbol and an emotion term, they generally agree, but they don't really always agree on what this emoji means linguistically. But if you're just asking people to react as if it was a feeling, that's when the correlations start going up. It indicates that you're able to use those images, bypass a little bit of that thinking brain and tap into the limbic brain where the emotions are processing and happening. So that was a real exciting development just this past fall.
Gosh, that's applause, no, without ending. Because, you know, when you guys mentioned to me when we were on the last time, which again, I think it was about 2 years ago, I remember going, that's spot on. Because I got to thinking about how I use emojis and my text messages and sending an email or whatever. And obviously, for me, it was a scratching of the surface, but it really got me thinking about how much I was using these emojis to express, at least in that moment, right? You know, what I'm feeling about X, Y, and Z. And to have you say that you've come to this milestone, I think that's just tremendous. So applause and congratulations.
Thank you.
And Michelle, you want to talk a little bit about our new tool that's an interesting way to collect data?
Right. So pivoting off of that data and going, okay, yes, our concept was proved. We are very pleased with that. Yeah. We got to thinking about, okay, where in the marketplace would this type of data be easy to understand, easy to adopt, and highly valuable? And as soon as we started asking those types of questions, we're like, oh gosh, video content. It's expensive to produce. It's expensive to place. We usually have a high level of expectation of the marketing value or the sales value that type of content is going to give back to us. And yet it's often difficult to make sure that the content that is produced for commercial use actually lands where we hope it will land. I mean, as a culture, we absolutely enjoy discussing the Super Bowl ads every year, right? Did they land? Were they really as funny? Which ones were snoozers? All that kind of stuff. Yep. So culturally, again, in the US,
Yep.
We absolutely love discussing this, and you know, it's like, man, I can't believe they just spent, you know, billions of dollars to place this in the Super Bowl, and then it just kind of went.
Right.
And frankly, for most businesses, the ability to get data, particularly consumer data, on, you know, especially something that's just a 30-second commercial that maybe you're going to run it online, maybe you're going to run it broadcast, whatever the case may be, it's just too expensive to go to Nielsen and do dial testing or something like that. Focus groups are really small, so while you can get a depth of understanding, it's kind of hard to extrapolate that out to a much larger population. And even focus groups are extremely expensive. But we're looking at our tech going, wait a second, we can already collect emotional responses at scale. What if we applied our emoji keyboard to a web page with a video embed and collected data for the video that way? So it harkens back a little bit to the original social videos. If you think back to when Facebook first started doing social video and when Periscope launched, which was eventually bought out by Twitter. If you remember, we mashed a small subset of things to just like indicate that I'm enjoying this, I support this, I whatever. So that same social mashing behavior, we want to take it forward into this consumer research realm and actually get some input as to, was the video good or not? But more than that, was the video effective for what it was you intended it to do? We can test fully completed videos to decide where we're going to place them as far as like ad buys and things like that. We can test concepts to see whether it's, you know, the concept is going to land with an audience before we even go into production. And of course, we can do production refinement where we've got something that's mostly complete, but hey, there's some budget there. We really want to make sure that as much as we're putting into this, that it's going to work. So we can also test multiple concepts, one against another, all kinds of stuff. And it's been really amazing. We actually had a client that used it for internal training videos. So think HR and like spotting those difficult situations that we often find ourselves in at work, and can you spot it? Do you react to it the right way? All those kinds of stuff. So we've actually had a client use a system that is basically meant for market research and use it for training within the workplace.
Wow. That's a lot, but that's
a lot.
But that, no, that's awesome. Cause you got me thinking, you know, hopefully I'm not going to throw this brand under the bus, but it absolutely drives me crazy. So, I tend to catch, radio, via Apple Music, and most of the shows are iHeart owned, right? Or
right.
That kind of thing. I swear every time that I click on any type of radio program, there's an ad for Con Air hair dryers. Now, I don't expect that Con Air knows that Eric Pennington does not have enough hair and probably is not using a hair dryer for styling purposes. However, do you know that, and I'm getting to a point now where I recognize the pattern. It typically will last for about 3 weeks to a month of every time I start the program, that commercial comes on. Maybe there's some idea that, hey, the more that I'm going to get more familiar with the brand and it, you know, on and on and on. But these are the times where I go, I wish I had an emoji test or I had somebody doing that with me. Like, use emojis to describe how you feel when you hear a commercial.
Right. That is a huge thing that's missing. We're missing in video analytics. We're missing the why. I mean, any video analytics platform can tell you, well, most of your audience drops off at 30 seconds, but none of them can tell you why. If you.
Here's the deal, right? And I don't want to go too far down the rabbit hole here, but, you know, my wife does have hair that is, you know, a hair dryer is appropriate and she could be in the market for it. But the likelihood of me saying, hey, I noticed that your hairdryer is on the it's glitching on you. I think you should look at Conair is very small.
Yeah.
Because right. I'm sort of irritated. Annoyed. Thank you.
Yeah.
With the commercial. But having said that, I know you're not necessarily doing audio yet, but
oh, we could.
I would say it would be a good
actually,
one
yeah, we can. We already yeah. can do that.
We can absolutely do audio,
and it's not, guys. And I know you know this. It's not that I'm saying it's a bad brand. They don't do X. No. They don't do Y at all, right? But it's like
it's an audience mismatch.
Well, yes. Thank you for that, Michelle, because that's the one thing. And I've said this for years. It's like you're speaking to me as if I am your ideal customer, but you don't even know, right? You have no clue. And I totally get it. My wife is in marketing. It's, you segment off a part of your budget just for these purposes, just to awareness, drip, whatever. But I think as a consumer, I want relevancy, mm-hmm. right? I want to see ads that relate to the things that are going to move me. So
yes.
yeah. Anyway.
Well, and there is an EQ component here that has been missing in what we do in marketing, advertising, that sort of thing. Tina, just a heads up, I'm heading toward the sweet spot. So one of the things we're able to identify is what is just that general emotional experience?
Right.
And if you're constantly annoying an audience, whether it's your audience or not, but I mean, you're hearing it at a frequency that now not only do I recognize Conair, but I associate it with a very annoyed emotional experience. And that goes to EQ, that goes to the neuroscience, that memories are cataloged and stored based on emotional experience. So if you're constantly having that annoying experience reinforced, how do you then feel about Conair as a brand overall? Not what they were going for, right?
I can't believe that they would want me to feel this way
right.
about their brand.
Right.
It's been impossible to predict. The old joke that marketers love to say is, your client just wants you to press the viral button, where you can just, I want to create a viral video. It's kind of like, doesn't really work that way because there has been a gap. What drives virality of content is emotions, and it's an emotional reaction to things.
Right.
That
also goes to velocity of emotion, right? It's not just that it's a positive or a negative, but usually viral type content triggered a very, very strong reaction in a lot of people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And sometimes that's not what you want. We frequently also talked about just the creation of scarcity, right? A lot of advertising around buy now, limited time only, Black Friday. Mm-hmm. Black Friday as a concept is not actually a real concept in the US anymore. And yet it's used to honestly create a little bit of stress, like you're going to miss out on the best deal of the season if you don't buy now. Well, right. What by and large is that doing to our potential customer base if we're constantly triggering them to be stressed out? Is that really what we want?
And you think also about shopping addiction. It's a real thing. That's mm-hmm. one of the things that we think about when we think about evoking transactional negative emotions like stress and anxiety and scarcity versus long-term positive brand affinity, like admiration, appreciation, excitement, love. We can put numbers to those that are, negative and transactional, that are not going, they're going to eventually be that Conair irritation connection in mind. Nothing wrong with the brand again, but
Because I want to go from that negative to a positive. And I my choices of what moves me from a consumer perspective is very much like I am with music. I just, when I hear it, I know it. Right.
Yeah.
So, you may be familiar with the jewelry line brand, David Yurman, right?
Yes.
And, many years ago, I remember I bought my wife his classic, I forget what he calls it, but it's a bracelet and it's kind of like a, it looks like a swirl of Roman columns. And then there's a, like a jewel on each end of the bead, right? Mm-hmm. Or a bracelet. But anyway, fast forward, I'm looking at buying a bracelet and I saw this ad and the ad was, I mean, it gave me a good feeling because I loved how they presented the look, the craft, the creativity, right? And then I went to their site and they've got like these videos and they go into the history, how David Yurman met his wife and what was their purpose behind. And I mean, this video was probably less than 5 minutes, but it pulled me in because it was hitting all of the things that inspire me. And I get it. Maybe whoever was behind the agency behind the video would not necessarily say, well, Eric, we knew you would be one of those people that really loved it. But there was just something in the way that they took that story of how they met and took that story of their creativity and why and generational, bringing their son in. And it was like, it was just such a wonderful story. And yeah, when I bought the bracelet, I bought it from them. And I'm sure there are probably, you know, other jewelry manufacturers, brands, whatever, that are higher quality and they're, you know, more respected, whatever. But I knew it when I heard it. It just, it resonated and it moved me, right?
Yeah.
And I do still get a ton of advertising messages from them via email, social media. But you know what? I don't feel any annoyance because I feel like, yeah, yeah.
Yes. It's so huge. Anyway, you're a lifelong customer versus a transactional customer. And I think many, many advertising and marketing research has gone into what's better. Do you stress people out and get them to act? Well, maybe you get a short-term payoff for that. But the long-term value really comes from building that emotional bond with the authenticity. So that is what we advocate for.
Well, and I think for the brands or the organizations that would work with you guys are in that camp. And maybe the executives at Con Air would say, hey, look, man, we're just trying to sell some hair dryers. That's all we want. We just need to move these hair dryers. And you know, if that's what works for them, what works for them. Let me pivot a little bit and talk about the workplace. And I know that in 2 years ago, as we spoke, you know, the dynamics of things just kind of coming off of out of the COVID deal. And I don't know necessarily how much of your model is still going to be in that workplace space. But you guys have a lot of great insight into that and how it connects into this data thing. So, right, you're hearing it so much. Okay, everybody's got to get back to work. We're no longer going to do this work from home thing. There's the, you know, well, I only want to work for a company where I can work from home. My daughter who lives in Seattle, you know, with her employer, it was one of these things of, well, if I have to come to the office, I've got to go through these toll roads and that's going to end up costing me another $3,000 a year. And I could just do this at home. Why do I need to on and on and on and on? Obviously, a lot of emotion on both sides of that equation, right? So any thoughts on what is happening there that maybe, I don't know, maybe an employer would like to know, hey, It's not just them protesting or throwing out their wishes. You could maybe find some data around why they're doing that.
Oh, we have cool stuff that? There.
Yeah, sorry.
I'm going to shout out to our biggest innovation partner, Perscolis, a nonprofit organization out of the Bronx. And they support, they provide free technical education for underserved communities and help them place themselves into or place into tech jobs. A longstanding multi-decade old nonprofit, and they love what we're doing and continuously work with us to help innovate. And the thing that we really landed on is because A, what we're asking is anonymous, and B, it's non-identifiable, the reaction. We can ask questions that you can't even really ask on a survey without people being nervous about answering, but we can ask it, we can get authentic reactions because the bias that people have about not wanting to deliver bad news, we have found isn't as present when you ask for an emoji. They're quick to just give you a thumbs down or an angry face because it's almost programmed in from social media. So we're able to gather very nuanced data about feelings, and we're packaging those into belonging. Let's measure where we are in at people's feeling of belonging in the organization, but then let's break it down into, well, how do people feel their sense of belonging as it relates to their leadership versus as it relates to their coworkers versus the level of understanding that they feel that versus the level of connectedness. So we can really hone in on all the different dimensions. And there are platforms like CultureAmp and others that can give you a single score on belonging. We've benchmarked against those, and we get a similar score, but then we can drive down into the why and the what that's really underneath that, which is our belonging score is maybe a 60, which is okay. Yeah. Could be a little higher. Well, what's going on? Well, these statistics actually show that people feel like they're not that connected between peers, but they're feeling a good sense of connection with leadership. So as an organization, perhaps focus your energy and team building on peer-to-peer relationships. Your peer-to-leadership relationships are doing really well. So we're able to dive into the different facets of these nuanced areas and then provide really actionable insights that's among belonging, among psychological safety, pride, and just trust.
Trust different and purpose.
In purpose. Yeah.
Yeah. So yeah. When you say that, it gets me to think about this idea of belonging. And if you ask the average leader, how do you know your people feel like they belong? Okay. So I'm trying to put myself in that position. Well, I'd have to, I'm going to be driven by emotion myself because I'm probably going to feel the pressure of, I don't really know, but I got to say something I got to find something to answer this question because I don't want it to seem like, so that's driving me because more than likely they don't know. I mean, they may say, yeah, we did an all employee survey last year and our scores were off the charts. But that doesn't necessarily, and if I'm hearing you guys right, that doesn't necessarily mean that it's all is good, right?
Right. Yeah. People's emotions change day to day, moment to moment. We use experience sampling. We don't ask people to remember things in the past. So we're getting, that time, the timestamp, what's happening now, what's the emotion, and what's the context?
So can you go back over that? I'm interrupting you, Tina. I'm sorry.
Yeah, no, you're fine.
You just said something earlier about our reluctance in survey taking. I think you were talking about like to say something negative, we tend to shy away from that. And is that something that you feel like is what your solution kind of overcomes that? And I think you may have already said it, but I'm just for my clarity. Is that what you were talking about?
Yeah, exactly. Memory bias is solved for, and the negativity bias, where we don't want to give bad news. Just as we've been trained to really suppress or ignore or not recognize our emotions historically, we've also been trained not to share news unless it's good news, and or fear of upsetting somebody that's a leader that you want to please. So this kind of tendency.
There's a people-pleasing bias to it.
Yeah. Yeah.
And, thinking back over a long period of time and going, well, how did I feel about that? I may feel different about it now than I did then. And of course, it also goes back to the emotional literacy. It's like, well, even if I'm talking about right now, I feel X, but is X a 3? Is it a 5? Is it a 7? Is it a, you know, just trying to match up how you feel to, you know, a number on a scale, or whether you agree or strongly disagree, or, you know, all those sorts of things.
And that's most of the emojis. Sorry to interrupt, but like most emoji scales are just a replacement for numbers. Mm-hmm. You know, you have the negative, super negative, the medium negative, this, the neutral, but ours is just love, you know, gratitude. It's the normal emojis that you use in social media or in text messages as part of our vocabulary.
Mm-hmm. You know, this also makes me think about another thing that Dr. Feldman, I'm just so terrible not remembering her name. But anyway, well, for our audience, we'll have it in the show notes and the episode from Andrew Huberman. She mentioned another thing about, they were discussing the limitations of our language in being able to be literate. And it was so fascinating. I guess, how does she describe it? In Japan, they have words to describe what happens when you have when you get a bad haircut. She went into that. She also went into, in German, there is a word for when you see someone and you just want to punch them in the nose. There's, and as much as it made me chuckle too, right? But it did get me thinking, you know, if you don't really have a way to associate it from a language perspective, it can be difficult, right? Mm-hmm. But I'm going to say my own lived experience with emojis, typically I can find it. I can scroll through, look at that. Oh, that's how I'm feeling, you know?
Yeah, you don't have to put the words to it.
Yeah, yeah. Boy, that's powerful. so from that perspective, And again, you said it in the beginning, you know, when we look at our cultural norm of pushing back on emotions, ignoring them, running away from them, whatever, how are these organizations sort of in the for-profit world receiving what you just described for the nonprofit?
Again, it's been a challenge. It's kind of funny, especially in the American culture, that there are definitely companies that look at their employee base as interchangeable parts. The concept of making your employees feel like they belong isn't even, you know, a thing. It's like, yeah, if I need to let a percentage of my workforce go so that, you know, my spreadsheet balances out, then I'm going to do it. So there's this concept, there's a disconnect between the humanity of our workforce and the financial responsibilities of our workforce.
Oh, Michelle.
Yeah. I went there. I totally went there.
Yeah. Well, if I may, you just really struck a chord about what I think is happening in many of our business schools as it relates to the MBA community, for example. What are they being taught? Mm-hmm. And my gut tells me, and this is not scientific by any stretch, I don't believe they're spending a ton of time on the humanity of the whole deal. I think the majority of the time is probably spent on profitability, expense ratios,
right,
headcount,
right,
those kind of things. And I think once you, if you could imagine that 26, 28 year old then goes out and maybe by the time they're 32-ish, right? They're in a leadership and then on. And all they've been told is everything is about earnings per share, shareholder value. And somebody comes along and says, but what about the human factor? You'll probably see the head cock, right? Like our dogs, you know? And I may be overstating it. And for those in our audience who have come out of the MBA world and all the rest, and if you've got something that says, oh, no, I just don't see it. But Matt, what do you guys think in that?
Well, I had so many thoughts. So first of all, why in the world do we call it soft skills? There's an indicator right there that all of these emotional intelligence skills, that human factor, are deemed as soft and somehow less valuable skills than other skills in the workplace. So that's a factor. Also, when you think about belonging, belonging comes from the experience of the day-to-day in the workplace. And there is a direct correlation between belonging or the lack thereof and turnover. It's like, if you're, you know, if you're trying to avoid the expense of high turnover rates and therefore high hiring rates, if that's, you know, really your pain point in your business, then yes, you need to be paying attention to how much belonging your employees experience in the workplace, because that could be a thing that could lower your turnover rates and take care of some expense. But at the same time, it's like, I have literally heard from people saying, yeah, but I don't want them to feel like they belong too much, or I can't get rid of them when I need to. So that's,
but you know what, that you say that, Michelle, in that example, and there's that part of me that says, you know, most people that are adults understand that they're not signing a lifetime contract with no chance of ever being let go. And I think as leaders, they just want you to be straight with them.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, yeah, I want you to stay in my company. I want you to be here. I want you to feel like you belong. And yes, you understand this is a business. And as a business, we do need to make money. We need to be profitable. And if we're not, yeah, we may have to make tough decisions that include, I have too much respect for human beings that an adult would be able to go, oh, that makes sense. I understand that, you know, but we don't go to that part. It's like, you know, we talk about, well, I could never, and we can't, because see, if we do that, then they'll think that, well, no, that's a cop out, because that's you not giving your people enough credit as adults. Mm-hmm. And are there a percentage of people out there who maybe did think that it was a family thing and it was always going to be this way and never, ever change? Yes, I'm sure there are. But I think the majority of people would understand.
Well, I'm also a proponent that that sense of belonging, that sense of connection, like we're in it together to accomplish something, also impacts productivity. Mm-hmm. So, and
customers.
Yep.
Like, this is the data that I have dreams of having enough to collect and look at someday, is let's look at the feelings of the employees and then connect that to the feelings of the customers. Because there, we know connection there, right?
Yeah.
We know that a sales, you know, you get on the phone with customer support, with whatever, you know, ticket, AT&T, whatever, and that person doesn't feel belonging, or that person just had a bad review, or that person had a bad interaction at work, you think that it's going to go really well with that customer. So there's a... where the emotions can follow the money, I think that's the ultimate way that we're going to, you know, cause this epiphany that I hope we can get to someday, which is it really matters, people.
Yeah. And you know what, guys, and for our audience, if you're watching this by video, you can see my face as Tina's outlining that. Those of you listening only by audio, right, who I'm going to use a brand again, and I really do like this brand. It's ASICS, the athletic shoe, running shoes and apparel, right? So I had bought some running shorts like back in September, and I just noticed about a week ago that their logo was peeling off of the garment, right? So it's like, I'm frustrated. I just, you know, I'm thinking, okay, maybe I should just go in the store. Maybe they'll just do a return, but I'm past the return time frame. So I might as well go ahead and see if I can take advantage of the warranty, that it shouldn't happen, blah, blah, blah. And the response I got was very much a stock. If this, then that, then you must. And here's this, it takes approximately this. And then once that happens, then we give you this. And if we decide, and then. Could that very well be true, that that's the process and it's the best process out there? Maybe so. But you know what I felt immediately? No empathy.
None. Mm-hmm.
Zero. No, wow, we're sorry that happened. Now, what you need to do, file a claim, is this. Then I'm kind of like, wait a minute, you heard me.
Yes.
You understand that it's frustrating to me. But it just went right by. And that's, in fairness to them, they're not the only company out there that I've experienced that kind of thing with. It's like, all you could have made this interaction so much more positive if you would have validated and given me some empathy that I'm not just calling you because I want to fight, or I'm not calling you or emailing you because I'm pissed about something that happened to me 2 days ago at work. I actually have a problem, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So when Tina, when you said that immediately, it's like, ding, you know? And by the way, I still love ASICs. That hasn't changed, but that's not a forever and a guarantee, though, you know?
It just reminded me of the, I do want to do some speaking in the industry for UX designers who would be responsible for those types of interactions, UX design with emotion. And I have a model for that, because after creating all of this technology and having to figure out all this emotions and how all they fit together and are they sequential and how do they relate to one another, there's a model that came out of this, and I would love for designers to use it to design UX user experiences with emotion in mind.
You know what? I'm going off the path, and I knew this was going to happen with you too, because I remember how great the conversation was the first time, and I've only got so much time because I do want to get to AI. But I have to say, Tina, this idea that you talked about with the model, right? I'm curious for both of you. Did you find, and I'm going to use the analogy of a tree. It's in my head right now, right? So when you planted this tree, which created these branches, right, going in different directions in different ways, what have you, is that kind of the idea of the model, whereas I know we have a tree, now we have branches that can go in different directions and touch in different ways. I see that in my head. Is that kind of what this model has done?
Kind of. The model I'm speaking to is another product that we are launching to the consumer market. Mm-hmm. Leverages that model to help you identify how you feel in the moment out of 152 different emotions, and using AI to help generate those images. Mm-hmm. And then it takes you through a sequence of micro mindfulness activities that lead you to emotional resilience, and then from positive emotion states to thriving. So it's just a large scale affinity clustering of emotions and dropping them into natural buckets and sequences type model. And that at its core does have a lot of branches and different applications that I can't wait to see explored.
Are you surprised, guys, by what you've blossomed into? I'm again going back to the tree and the plant idea.
I'm personally not, because we've been told to rein it in so many times.
Oh, that's like, great.
Yeah, all these ideas are great, but it's difficult to make it work in the marketplace. That
I get the finger wag.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, I think you guys, well, you already know how I feel about you. So, and I'm confident that this is producing and will produce. Okay, because of limited time, I want to touch a little bit on AI. And if we can't get this one all nailed down in this conversation, I'd love to have you back. Obviously, you know, it's the flavor of 2023, right? And everybody is flocking to it. We've had some episodes on the podcast where we've talked about it a bit. We've not talked to anybody in the technology space, or those that have somewhat of a touch to that, be it historically or current.
Mm-hmm.
When you think about the following quote, and I may not get it exactly right, Larry Summers, who is probably most known for being, I think he was the Treasury Secretary for, it might have been Obama, it might have been Clinton, I can't remember, and Harvard, president of Harvard at one time, and he is now on the board of OpenAI. We'll save the OpenAI drama piece, but he's brought on as a new director. And So one of the things in this quote, he said that AI is probably a threat to IQ, but very unlikely to be one for EQ. And I just thought, wow, that's pretty interesting that this guy was, number one, talking about EQ, right? But how he phrased that idea. When you think about AI, whether it's implications for the good, the bad, and in between, how do you think it plays with, does it play well with EQ?
I think about it in a couple of different buckets. That's some systems brain. There's the individual's relationship with AI. There's the organization's relationship with AI. And then there's the change management piece. The change is inevitable. Yeah. As an individual who consumes, uses AI on the daily, I have positive feelings to AI because I feel like it's the least complaining, hardest worker I have to get what I need done quickly. An organization's relationship to AI is more complicated because you have to start thinking about which humans and are replaceable or augmentable, or how should their job roles shift and change with AI? Mm-hmm. And then how do you manage that change? So those are the buckets. And then I'm going to let Michelle dive in a little deeper on some of those.
Yeah.
Well, I'll also say I would tend to disagree with his initial statement in that, yes, I think that there is a challenge not only to IQ, but also to EQ, that we still, with AI, especially generative AI in its current state, that we can't abdicate our own judgment and experience and those things that do play into EQ. We can't abdicate those to AI, that AI is likely to make all kinds of mistakes, and in some cases, absolutely horrifying mistakes. I have heard stories of like universities responding to an on-campus shooting, allowing AI to compose the letter that goes out to the student body, and it was talk about a lack of empathy. It's like, I'm sorry, AI is a machine. It cannot be empathetic.
No.
It also takes in a lot of our own biases. So when you think about it, the AI, especially AI that has been trained on the internet, it's been trained on all of the trash of the internet, as well as all of the information in the internet. So it's going to have a tendency to engage and possibly amplify all the same biases that we do every day. And so, yes, I do believe that generative AI and some of the ways that we right now this year use AI, that yes, it is a challenge to EQ, and we need to engage even more in our emotional intelligence skills when using AI than maybe we do, you know, on a daily basis without it. And Tina's nodding, so apparently I said something right.
Yeah, and I would add to that, Michelle, Tina, the essence, the true definition, at least for us, is that emotional intelligence, when it is operating at a high level, is when the prefrontal part of your brain and the emotional, right, to your point earlier, the emotional center work together, like a fusion idea, right? They're not designed to work independently of one another. I mean, we've gotten away with it in our culture, right? Being able to, you know, because let's go back to the beginning of our conversations, ignore it, run from it, don't talk about it, leave it at the door, and then embrace all of the intellectual logic stuff. And I think firmly it's cost us. So I think, once again, the two together that's how they're meant to play, right?
Yes. One thing that I'm a little nervous about, to be honest, is the leveraging the Feelalytics to train the AI. It if you gather enough data points about enough individual humans and you gather enough context points, because we have a context point and an emotion, the AI could probably see and find trends that humans wouldn't be able to, and maybe learn more about us than we think is possible. So I'm a little nervous about that, honestly.
Does that come into the safeguarding idea?
Yes, it does. Also, it also goes back to the idea that while we may feel one way about a very specific thing on a very specific day, our emotional states change. Our feelings towards something may change.
Yeah.
Your ASICS example is really good, that for the most part, you feel very positive about it, but there was this one incident that was like, not so great. And if we're training, God, I even hate saying it. If we were to use something like Feelalytics to train AI, it's still not going to take into account the in-the-moment aspect of it. That although, by and large, people feel X, Y, or Z about this thing, that was in that moment. And as things change and there's more context, people are constantly changing their mind, the experience of it could be different for any number of factors, both internal and external. And so, although obviously that type of computing power has the capacity, it's like you're gonna have to constantly continue to ask the human beings how they feel about that in order to really get enough sampling of the change, the fluidity of what emotions are.
Well, and I will, we'll make sure to get this in the show notes. There's a video out there from a neuroscience conference that one of my favorite musical artists of all time, Pat Metheny, is he was a speaker as well as he was on a panel, right? So you're with me, you're in my tribe.
Yes, I love Pat Metheny.
Okay. So one of the things that he said in that panel discussion that I thought was just profound, the interviewer was asking him about emotions and about how music can, spark and, the memories and on and on. And they asked him, do you think we'll get to a place where we'll be able to absolutely identify what musical notes create X, Y, and Z feelings, blah, blah, blah. And I'm paraphrasing here, guys, because the interview is just, it's mind blowing. He said, the only problem is that after those sequence of events, the note being played, what is being felt, you can go further, but eventually you're going to run into the soul. And Michelle, what you were just talking about, he was kind of alluding to this idea that the soul is so dynamic from person to person to be able to say A minor seventh always or consistently makes people feel X. It's not like that's a forever thing.
Right.
It's a great view. But anyway,
also reminds me a little bit of tactics and things used in grief therapy, in that when we're going through the grieving process, we need to allow ourselves to feel that. And sometimes it is helpful to play a sad song or whatever in order to move through that grief process. But what is fascinating to me is that people that use that tactic in order to move through that grief, eventually the catharsis of the quote unquote sad song becomes something where instead of feeling sad, they feel joy or relief or any number of other things, because that song is associated with that progression through. It's like no longer does that song trigger sadness immediately, but my experience over time using that song to work my way through grief, I now feel something completely different after hearing that song for the 50th, 60th, 100th time, as opposed to what I did when I first started listening to it.
Wow. That's just fantastic. Well, I'm going to use that as our launching point to concluding because that's a beautiful way to end our conversation. Tina, Michelle, I cannot thank you enough for coming back on. And for sure, we're not going to go for another 2 years. We're going to get you back. And we're running now. We're recording this episode toward the end of 23, so definitely in 24. And can't thank you enough. Well, for our audience, we'll have Feelytics information in the show notes, information if you want to get a hold of these folks to talk about what they do. Hopefully, you'll do that, because I think you'll be definitely pleased that you did. And man, I can't thank you enough. I've enjoyed this time with you both.
Thank you, Eric.
For our audience, we look forward to the next time that we're together. Take care.
Hi, everyone. This is Eric again. A couple of things as we've ended the show. We hope you enjoyed it. Hopefully, you're tuning in on a regular basis. We'd love it if you would give us a great review on whatever platform you're listening to the podcast. It's so appreciative and helps us as we try to get more exposure for the work we do and the episodes that we publish. And we're grateful to you as a listener. The second thing is, just remember, our content is for educational purposes only. It's not intended by any stretch to diagnose or to treat anything that may be occurring in your life or anyone else's life that you may be connected to through the podcast. But once again, we appreciate you tuning in to the shows. And as always, we look forward to the next time that we're together. Take care.